We are on the record in House Labor and Commerce. The time is 3:23. Members present are Representatives Clum, Freer, Fields, Hall, Sadler, and Nelson. Thank you, Andrew Magnuson, LNC Committee Secretary, and Renzo Moises from the Juneau LIO for tech and teleconferencing support. We have four bills on the agenda today. House Bill 249, Transfer Vehicle Title. House Bill 260, Construction Project Wage Liability. House Bill 352, Healthcare Licensing Compacts. And House Bill 305, Transportation Network Company Pay. First up is House Bill 249 by Representative Moore. Representative Moore, thank you for being here. Please come forward. Do members have any questions for the bill sponsor, her staff, or the department? Okay. We also have, I believe we have Kathy Wallace. No, we have Mark Binder online, who I think we heard from last time, if anyone has any additional questions. So we did have an amendment deadline. There was one amendment which I submitted. If people don't have questions on the underlying bill, I will move Amendment 1. I guess, hearing no objection, Amendment Number 1 passes. Madam Co-Chair, do you have a motion?
Somewhere. Mr. Co-Chair, I move to report HB 249 Work Order 34-LS1279/A out of committee with individual recommendations, or as amended, with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 249 does pass out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. We will now take a brief at ease to sign their paperwork and transition to the next hearing. Back on the record in House Labor and Commerce, Representative Carrick joined the committee at 3:26 p.m. Next up on the agenda, third hearing on House Bill 260, Construction Project Wage Liability with Representative Josephson. Representative Josephson, staff is here if members have further questions before we take action on the bill. Are there further questions for the bill sponsor's staff?
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor's representative. Curious, if when you spoke with the contractors industry, what were their reactions to the changes in law proposed by HB 260? Did you speak with representatives of the Associated General Contractors and Alaska Builders and Contractors? And if so, what were their opinions?
Through the chair, thank you, Ken Alper, for the record, staff to Representative Josephson. To Representative Sadler, we did not directly. We were working with advocates of different organizations that were that came to Representative Josephson with this concept. My understanding is they are actively talking with the industry and got feedback from them, but I don't have a solid answer to give you that one. I'm sorry.
So I understand from your answer, sir, that the sponsor did not talk with ABC or AGC, but that other organizations did. And if so, which are those organizations, please?
Mr. Chairman, the invited testimony that came from some of the labor groups were the original advocates that brought this bill to our office, and perhaps the Representative Sadler's question might better be addressed to them.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. So you're saying that the invited testifiers are the ones with whom you've been working, and those invited testifiers are talking to AGC and ABC? I don't make sure I understood what you said correctly.
Through the chair, that's my understanding, and I'm a little bit past my specific knowledge. I don't know who's been talking to who, but this is a conversation, my understanding, within the construction industry has been going on for some time, and these conversations have happened. I don't know specifically who spoke to who when, but I guess your question through the chair is, are the contractors supportive of this change that we're making? And I honestly don't know the answer.
Last question, everyone. Anybody
else? Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Yeah, because this is a bill that touches very directly on their business practices. I would hope that we can get the contractors' associations in the record to find out what they think of it. That would be a good policy and good procedure, I would think.
Thanks, Representative Sadler.
Thank you.
They are not online to offer such feedback now. Does anyone else have further questions? Go ahead, Rep. Clum.
Yeah, through the chair, I'm just getting clarification. So this bill is proposing that if a subcontractor's workers aren't paid, that the project owner would pay, And I looked at the project owner definition on the back, but I guess I need some clarification. I thought initially it would be the general contractor that hired the subcontractor that would pay. But is that correct, or is it the person who hired the general contractor that would have to pay?
So through the chair to Representative Coulombe, thank you for asking that. That's an important question. Mm-hmm. The general contractor, always, they would be responsible. The project owner, sometimes, depending on the nature of the project owner. And then there's exceptions in the bill, and I should probably find the specific section, but the project owner would not be liable if it's an individual homeowner or a small project or something like that. But if the project owner is fundamentally a major developer themselves, then they could potentially have liability for the unpaid wages as well.
Can I follow up?
Yes, I apologize.
Sorry. Okay, so potentially it could be the person that hired or the company that hired the general contractor. What would make it go all the way up that high, and what would make it just the general contractor to pay for the wages?
Through the chair, I believe this would be a question of enforcement that the Department of Labor would engage with. They would, the goal ultimately is to get the employees paid, right? Someone did the work. Their direct employer has not paid them. Perhaps they've disappeared. They've left the state. They've dissolved. And then they have no recourse. The intent of the bill is to create recourse to the person that hired that subcontractor, which is the general contractor. If the general contractor, for some reason, can't be accessed, there are circumstances where it might be the project owner. Or sometimes the project owner is functionally working as a general contractor, and they might be the one hiring the subcontractor. So the key in crafting this was just making sure that we're not putting sort of the regular person who has nothing to do with the construction industry on the hook. And that's why this exemption for, say, a project owner that's really a homeowner working on their own home shouldn't be liable for something like this.
Yeah, but a follow-up. But it wouldn't have to be a homeowner. I mean, it could be a hospital. It could be a business. They're not in the construction industry. But they could possibly be liable to pay those wages if the general contractor wasn't?
Through the chair to Representative Coulombe, I found the section here. We're in the Part B of Article 9, starts in the middle of page 2 of the bill. These are the things that does not apply. And it says Part Sub 3 there, B3. A project owner, if the construction contract relates to real property consisting of one commercial unit. So your hospital would probably fall into that category. In other words, this isn't a major multifaceted development. It's only a large development where a project owner would potentially be brought into this.
Representative Taylor, we actually have members who have other bills in other committees, so let's do one more question and then proceed to a vote just that because we're compressed on time today.
I had another question too.
All right, two more questions, one Coulombe, one Sadler, and then we'll move on. Go ahead, Rep. Coulombe.
Thank you. Through the chair to the sponsors, representative. Looking at page 1 of the bill, lines 9, line 8 through 10, I just want to make sure I understand for the record what the consequences are of the sanction. One is a 90-day suspension of a contractor's registration, and the other is permanent revocation. Can you tell me what, is there ever a lifetime chance to have that registration resumed or recovered somehow, or is this a lifetime ban? I mean, what do these mean for practical purposes?
Mr. Chairman, it's important to remind the committee that the section that Representative Sadler is kind of referencing here was amended by his amendment that reduces that consequence to a third offense and not a second offense as written in the bill. As far as one's ability to reinstate or reform under a different name and recreate, although I am not qualified to answer that question. I believe you have someone from the Department of Commerce in the room that might actually, who's involved with business licensing, might be better able than me to answer that question.
Ms. Robb, would you like to address that question?
Sorry to put you on the spot.
It's okay. For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, through the chair to Representative Sadler, construction contractor could reform with a new name if they had received that third strike and were permanently barred from conducting business under their existing name.
Chair, I'm not sure it could reform under a new name. What's the procedure there? Legally, I'm not sure what that means.
Through the Chair to Representative Sadler, 75% of our construction contractor licensees are corporate entities, and so they could form a new corporation with a different name and begin doing business under that corporation.
Rob, we're going to go to Rep. Colom now.
Through the
Representative Sadler, we're going to go to Rep. Colom, and then we're going to take a vote just because other members have other bills. And
sure. Well, we have this bill before us now, sir.
And Rep. Colom is up.
Well, I'd like to get in the queue, please.
Through the chair, does this apply to government contracts, the government hiring general contractors?
Through the chair, I don't see why it would not. It doesn't explicitly say one way or the other, and I hadn't contemplated the question, but the way I read the bill, yes, it would.
Okay.
I apologize for cutting off debate. We have a compressed schedule because of the floor. We have other members who have to present bills. So at this time, do you have a motion, Representative Hall?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sadler, we're going to take a vote on the bill, and I apologize that members can do more research on the bill as it moves through the next steps.
But I won't have the chance to ask my question in this committee in which I serve.
Representative Sadler, we have to move on at this time. I apologize.
Well, just for the record, I'm being cut off from performing on my job.
Okay.
So many things I want to say. Mr. Co-Chair, I move to report HB 260 Work Order 34-LS1242/N as amended out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Object.
There is an objection. Will the Secretary call the roll?
May I speak to my objection?
Sure. You can speak to your objection.
Yeah. If we don't have the contractors here to ask questions, if I don't have the right to ask more of my questions, this bill should not proceed.
Okay. I would just note the contractors have fantastic representatives. They certainly know how to find me and submit their opinions on any bill before this committee. Will the Secretary call the roll?
Representative Freer.
Yes.
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Colom.
No.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Co-Chair Fields.
Yes.
Co-Chair Hall.
Yes.
5 yea, 2 nay.
By a vote of 5-2, House Bill 260 is reported from committee. Please sign the paperwork. I'm going to keep rolling because we have a lot of invited testifiers on the next bill. The next bill is House Bill 352, Healthcare Licensing Compacts, which I introduced at the request of the Health Commissioner. My staff, Courtney Owen, is here if members have questions. However, I want to... If members don't have life and death questions of me or Ms. Owen, I actually want to ask that Dr. Jenna Schmidt come offer her invited testimony because she's waiting in the audience and has made time to testify on this bill. Thank you, Dr. Schmidt, for being here to testify on House Bill 352.
Hello, my name is Dr. Jenna Schmidt. I'm representing myself and the Alaska Academy of Family Physicians in support of House Bill 352. Compact licensure for physicians is a common sense legislature that will remove barriers to physicians practicing in Alaska, improve access to specialty services, and overall improve the paperwork burden of licensure. It is also my understanding that compact licensure improves timelines without compromising appropriate licensing requirements. As someone who grew up in rural Alaska and went through the WAMI program, I always knew that I wanted to practice in this state. I did my residency and fellowship training outside of Alaska with a clear intent to return. Thankfully, since I knew what I wanted to do, I started early. It took me 8 months to get my temporary license to practice in Alaska and start my job. Recently, I helped an Alaskan trainee from the Lower 48 residency come to a rotation with my group, and they had to go through a three-month licensing process. The other notes that I went to got deleted, but it improves access to specialty services, something that we are always working on, trying to connect our patients with, And we want to have people come from the lower 48 to come do rotations up here, fall in love with Alaska. There's so many transplants that contribute to the brain gain here in Alaska. So from a primary care perspective, this bill makes sense, and I recommend you proceed with it.
Thank you, Dr. Schmidt, for finding time to be here with us today. Are there questions for Dr. Schmidt? Okay. We do have other invited testifiers, so thank you, Dr. Schmidt, for being here. Next up is Dr. Ann Zink. Dr. Zink, if you can hear us, please proceed with your testimony.
I can hear you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Thank you so much. So to the chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present today and to testify. As mentioned, I'm Dr. Ann Zink. I'm a practicing emergency medicine physician. I would note that I am only testifying for myself, but in strong support of HB 352. I also want to state my strong support for the nurse compacting, which I know is not a part of this bill, but same broader effort. Much as like you heard before, compacting reduces unnecessary bureaucracy, as well as reducing costs and giving back time for everyone involved in the process. The stories you just heard from Dr. Schmidt are pervasive and across the entire state. This will help reduce bureaucracy for providers who want to work in Alaska, reduce bureaucracy for hospitals, clinicians, and care teams trying to recruit them, and reduces bureaucracy for the state. As a practicing emergency physician, as well as the former medical director for our group at Matsu Regional and the former chief medical officer for the state, one of the most common concerns I heard from all of these different positions was the inefficiency and the time it took both to do the paperwork for licensing as well as the licensing team to be able to get that back. And that concern is not theoretical, it has real impacts on patients' care, access, hiring, and recruitment. And while licensing takes long, positions stay vacant or never get filled, and recruitment gets harder, teams get stretched thinner, and Alaskans wait for longer care. One of the single best ways to recruit Alaskan physicians to the state is to provide opportunities to work in Alaska. Providers should be spending their time recaring for patients, not redefining old paperwork, completing repetitive forms, or navigating cumbersome licensure processes. Hospitals and clinicians should be spending their time recruiting, onboarding, supporting the workforce they need, not walking a new hire through the maze of licensing. And the state should have more time to focus on the work that most matters, like protecting the public, oversight, complaints, investigation, and ensuring high quality providers. There is real work to do in healthcare. We need to improve the patient experience. We need to improve workplace experience, the people delivering care. We need to address healthcare costs, and we need to be thoughtful about monopolization, commercialization, and outside interests to try and take advantage of Alaskans. But those issues should be addressed directly and ideally in the most local and patient-focused way we can. We should not be defending inefficiencies as if they were quality. Compacting preserves the standards of Alaska and Alaskan autonomy while reducing bureaucracy. And it's for all those reasons I strongly support HB 352 as well as the nurse compacting bill. It is really great to see all of you, and thank you for your time and all the work that you're doing to serve Alaskans.
Thank you. Are there questions for Dr. Zink? Representative Fettler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Dr. Zink, appreciate it. Good to see you again. Were you reading testimony you had prepared? And if so, would you be willing to send that to me by email?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I'd be happy to send it to you, and I was reading it.
Oh, great. It looked like you were very eloquent, but thank you very much.
Okay, Representative Carrick.
Thank you, Dr. Zink, so much for being here. And I just wanted to run through a couple potential concerns that were brought up, and generally I'm pretty supportive of the idea of compacting as well, but we've heard potential concern for the psychologist compact about potentially excluding non-CPA APA graduates because the compact wouldn't currently cover those individuals. And additionally, we've heard just the overarching concern with compacts that you may have professionals who are coming up here to work for a couple of days and then going back to a home state and not establishing residency in Alaska. And I was just hoping that if you had a comment on either of those two concerns, if you could kind of speak to that.
Yeah, Representative, through the chair, I really appreciate those concerns and have heard similar concerns amongst physicians and amongst practicing members. I would highlight that this provides an alternative way to get licensed. It does not replace the Alaska state licensing process, and Deputy Commissioner Sylvan Robb could speak more to that process, but there is the opportunity to apply directly through the state if people choose to be able to do that. So there is other opportunities. This compacting just helps to streamline and smooth out a lot of the process. Regarding your second concern, and a concern I oftentimes hear is this is going to recruit a bunch of locums or people who aren't going to work in the state to come and then to be able to leave. And I hear those concerns. And, you know, as an emergency medicine physician, it's really hard to do my job remotely. And I want clinicians who are in town with me. If I get a big car accident, I can call them in for help and not have someone else who's far away and is having a harder time to be able to respond locally. There are additional manifestations and opportunities to provide those checks and balances. So the ways that hospitals do their privileges can require physicians to be within, say, 30 minutes, or that they have residency. So I think that there's additional mechanisms to do that. I also think that there are increasing services that are available via telehealth. You know, so at Matsu Regional, we use teleneurology regularly to assess stroke patients at real time and at the bedside, and that really speeds up our time to be able to see and evaluate patients. But I'll have to tell you that onboarding process of getting all those neurologists licensed in the state of Alaska and then through all the hospital process as well takes an incredibly long time. So I think we have to rely on other checks and balances to make sure that inpatient and in-person support services are there and available, but not try to have the slowness of and the duplication of the licensing be the one mechanism that we use.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Dr. Zink. You know, there are professional associations in Alaska. There are professional relationships. There's personal relationships. I know that the medical community is trauma bonded and, you know, very close, and they communicate. But I'm just curious if the thought came to me, what is it likely to do to the community of physicians in Alaska when we open up licensure to compact licensure? Said, do you think people will join the state associations? Will they form their own, you know, locums associations? Just help me understand the society of the physicians in the state if this were to become law.
Yeah, Representative Sadler, through the chair, it's a great question. You know, I've been trying to understand more broadly how this has impacted other states. To the previous question as well, is this bringing up a lot of locums who are going to come and then leave and not really be a part of societies or not be a part of committees or be a part of the community? I could not find any evidence in other states that have had compacting for significantly longer periods of time. There was some initial reports that came out of Texas that I was specifically looking at. I don't have those on the top of my hand. But looking at the fact that we really didn't see a major change there. We really train in an incredibly urban-centric environment, particularly as physicians. We train at big urban centers where we can come and we can learn, and that's where people end up staying. And so when we get the opportunity to rotate or to experience life in Alaska as a clinician, you know, we only have one family medicine residency. So it's really hard for a cardiologist to know what it's really like to work up here, particularly if you're used to working in an incredibly specialized environment. So I think it makes a lot of sense to have people come up for a year or two, be a part of that community, see if this is the right fit for them. And when I've been practicing now in Alaska for 18 years, recruiting physicians for a whole broad range of specialties to support Matsu as well as the state as a whole, a lot of times when people come up, they love it. And they love the community, they love the practice, they love the patient stories and autonomy and the ability to practice directly with their community, and they choose to stay for good reason. So I think this, just as Dr. Schmidt had testified previously, allows us to give new students and residents the opportunity, who I do think like to be involved in the process of being involved in policy change. So as a result, involved in their associations and involved with people like you, helping to make good policy to serve patients better.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Zink, for being here. I don't see further questions. Next up in invited testimony is Kevin Tarlow. Mr. Tarlow, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. for the record, my name is Dr. Kevin Tarlow. I am a licensed psychologist and here representing the Alaska Psychological Association, ACPA. We do have a couple slides to share with you. I see those on the screen now. On to slide two, I want to thank the committee for giving us an opportunity to update you. We were here last week sharing some results of a survey that we gave to our members. ACPA is an interdisciplinary organization that represents psychologists and other allied mental health professionals in Alaska. We surveyed our membership about support for joining the psychology compact, SCIPAC, and we shared some preliminary results with you last week. I'm here to give an update now that we have a better sense of where our membership stands. On to slide three. Just quick background, SCIPAC is not a new compact. It actually, the work began on SCIPAC in 2014. And Compact was enacted in 2019. There's currently 41 member states, and Alaska is one of five states currently considering legislation to join. On to the next slide. Practicing with SciPact, it's a two-step process. Just for clarification, licensed psychologists in any member state has to first obtain what's called an e-passport. It's a credential from the Association of State and Provincial Psychology Boards, ASPPB. Once you have the e-passport, then psychologists may apply for either the authority to practice interjurisdictional telepsychology, APIT, which permits you to practice across jurisdictions with other member states, or you can apply for a temporary authorization to practice, which would allow you to practice for up to 30 days in a calendar year in person in another member state. On to slide number five. Psychologists are not able to obtain an e-passport if they have any history of disciplinary action on any of their professional licenses. And to clarify, because I think there were questions about this last week, psychologists with either the APIT or the temporary authorization of practice in person must comply with all local laws, both in the state they're practicing from and the state they're practicing into, where the patient would be located. Another important point of clarification, because this just came up talking about the medical compact, SciPact clinicians must declare their home state in order to seek the APIT to practice across jurisdictions. If I'm in Alaska, I have to be licensed in Alaska in order to participate in SciPact and to practice across jurisdictions. So there's no diverting of licensing fees away from psychologists' state of residence. You can't just seek out the most affordable license in any SciPact member state and then use that license to practice across all SciPact member states. You have to be licensed in the state where you, the provider, reside. On to slide number six. This was another point of clarification from last week. That as of last summer, there are now six different pathways for psychologists in member states to qualify for an e-passport, which is the credential which allows you to then seek authorization of practice through telehealth or in person. The most common way to qualify for an e-passport is to hold a doctoral degree from an APA-accredited doctoral program. The American Psychological Association, that's the primary national accreditor for doctoral-level degree programs in professional psychology. APA is recognized by the Department of Education as well as CHEA for pre-accreditation and accreditation of professional psychology programs. There's currently 430 doctoral programs accredited by APA across all 50 states. Why I'm talking about this, onto the next slide, slide seven, this is relevant for understanding SciPact in Alaska because Alaska has two doctoral degree granting programs in psychology. One of them, the program at the University of Alaska Anchorage, is APA accredited. And then the program at Alaska Pacific University is not APA accredited, so we have a mix of psychologists in Alaska that have degrees from APA accredited programs and degrees from non-APA accredited programs. As I mentioned, there are six different pathways to qualify for the e-passport. One of the new pathways that was added last summer would provide an avenue for non-accredited degree holders to qualify for the e-passport. We're seeking clarification. I just spoke with Janet Orwick, who's the executive director of SciPact this afternoon, and we're trying to determine if the APU program would meet that pathway for qualification, which would allow APU degree holders in Alaska to seek the e-passport credential. So that's something that I know is relevant to our members, and if we go on to the next slide, I can share with you the updated results of our survey.
Dr. Tarlow, can I just jump in for 1 second?
Yes.
We will be happy to check with the Department of Health about whether they have an update on that APU program eligibility under SciPact, and thank you for raising that as an area for us to do further research.
Okay, thank you.
And sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine. For our survey, we have about half of our members who hold an active psychology license have responded to our survey, so we're pretty pleased with the response rate that we've gotten. We think we have a pretty good idea of where our membership stands with regard to the compact. We asked our members, do you support Alaska adopting SciPact? Members were able to express a range of opinions about that. On to slide 9, a majority of our members who respond to the survey strongly support SciPact. If you combine the members who both strongly supported or somewhat supported, that number goes up to about 2/3. Our members support SciPact by a ratio of about 3-1. Half of the members who opposed SciPact are themselves not eligible for the e-passport under accreditation requirements. So we're hoping that we can clarify the accreditation issues for APU graduates that might, I think, would address some of those concerns. On to the next slide, slide 10. We asked members who responded to the survey to identify the top benefits of joining SciPact. The top three benefits they named, half of our members said, providing continuity of care for patients. We serve a lot of patients in Alaska because of work. They're working in energy, they're in the military, they're in tourism, they might travel between jurisdictions a lot, and it's really hard to maintain continuity of care as a result of that. So this would offer an opportunity to provide good continuity of care for patients who travel between states. The next top benefit was increased access for rural Alaskans, and then other members mentioned professional mobility. On to the next slide, we also asked about top concerns of joining SciPact. The top concern shared was exclusion of non-APA graduates, which I've talked about. Members also expressed concern about cultural competence. Do folks practicing from other jurisdictions understand what it's like being in Alaska? Do they have the right sense of the place and community to be able to provide good services to Alaska residents? Other issues that came up, insurance reimbursement concerns, and then no major concerns was another top option that our members endorsed. On to the last slide, slide 12. Our board of directors for ACPA is meeting just in a couple hours. We're going to review the survey results as a group and issue our official position. We're happy to share that with the committee by the end of this week. On our agenda is to try and sort of tease apart the two different issues I think that come up. There's issues about professional practice. Is SciPact going to be a benefit to professionals in Alaska, to psychologists here? And then sort of weighing the benefits and concerns for professionals against the benefits and concerns for the public welfare. And so recognizing those two different sort of issues are both a part of our mission for ACPA. So I'm happy to share that with you. And I know that Dr. Tucker's going to talk. And I also want to mention Patrick Hyde is here. Is that he's the chair of the SciPact Commission, and maybe I'll answer some of your questions about SciPact. So thank you. Thank you to the committee, to the chair.
Thank you, Dr. Tarlow. So do members have questions for Dr. Tarlow, or we were just joined by Patrick Hyde from SciPact? Go ahead, Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Dr. Tarlow, you know, this being some 80, 90-page bill, I have not had the chance to review each of the compacts in detail, but in the referring to the compact for psychologists and psychological associates, I note that, and maybe I'm just have missed this, but this is not intended to provide permanent licensure as other compact licensure bills would have. This is intended for temporary in-person, no more than 30 days, or telehealth, telepsychology. Am I understanding the compact correctly?
Through the chair, yes, that's correct. There's basically two different options for practice for people who have the e-passport. You can either apply for that APIT, which allows you to practice across jurisdictions using telepsychology through telehealth, or you can have that temporary authorization of practice in person. So this SciPact does not allow a psychologist from, let's say, I'm also licensed in Virginia, so I can't be a psychologist licensed in Virginia, move permanently to Alaska and practice in Alaska under my Virginia license. I have to, if I'm in Alaska, I have to be licensed by the state of Alaska to practice here. I could have a temporary authorization of practice under my Virginia license if I'm an e-passport holder, which would maybe give me time to seek licensure in the state of Alaska. but it does not provide a permanent option for psychologists licensed in other states to practice in person here residing in Alaska without an Alaska license to practice. I hope that answers the question.
It does, kind of. If I may follow up?
Sure.
Thank you. So I guess to what extent is this the temporary and telehealth provision to expand the licensure and therefore the extend access to psychologists, to what degree is that going to satisfy the need in Alaska for psychological services?
So through the chair, one way that I think the profession of psychology has changed in recent years is just the growing prevalence of telehealth services, particularly for things like specialty services that might not be available in the state of Alaska. So it does expand, I think, access to providers outside of Alaska for communities who might not have easy access to services here in, you know, in-person services. So I think in that way, it would be very beneficial. And I think that's something we've seen in the 41 states that have adopted SciPact, where it makes it easier for residents to find the right provider that's sort of going to provide the service that they need, because they're no longer limited to providers in their state. They can potentially seek specialty care through telehealth for providers that are in other states.
Thank you. If I may sharpen the question, I appreciate that through the chair. I understand the mechanism and the theory behind it, but my question is more quantify how much of the needs of Alaskans for psychological services would be served by this. Half, a quarter, a third, 100, what percentage? I'll give you a rough.
Through the chair, I don't know if I can give a specific number. I'm happy to consult with our board that's meeting tonight and see if anybody has that information, and I'd be happy to share it.
Even a general number, I'm just trying to get some sense of how this would affect the practice of psychology in Alaska, whether it's massive, significant, or minor. So some measure would be useful.
Through the chair, so the American Psychological Association, APA, they have a Center for Workforce Studies, and they do monitor what the sort of the need for psychological services is across different states, and what states have an unmet need versus states that have a surplus of services. I think that's one way to maybe understand the question you're asking. Alaska is kind of in the middle of the pack. We're with many other states who have a shortage of psychologists. Our shortage is, compared to the size of our population, is not as severe, but we do have a shortage of services, and this would again expand the pool so that maybe states that have more psychologists than they need are able to provide services that are needed here. I don't have the numbers, but again, I can try and get those to you in our follow-up.
Through the chair, Dr. Todd, yeah, I'd be very much appreciated. That would be very helpful if you could find out what the APA measurements of Alaska's need and satisfaction of that need are, and provide it to me at least. That'd be great. I appreciate it.
And thank you, Dr. Tarlow. We have another psychologist, Dr. Brock Tucker, Assistant Professor of Psychology from UAA, up and invited testimony as well. Thank you, Dr. Tucker, for being here.
Hello. I was just informed my camera is not working. I apologize. for the record, my name is Dr. Brock Tucker. I'm here in my capacity as a private citizen, not a University of Alaska professor. I'm also a combat veteran out of Dewey Bear. I came up here to Alaska with 4,000 paratroopers in 2005. So I ended up specializing in veterans' mental health, but our program here at UAA has a focus on rural and Alaska Native mental health as well. So through my training, I've practiced at several tribal health organizations, and today I'd like to talk a little bit about how I think SciPact through HB 352 would have a positive impact on our military and veteran community and our Alaska Native community up here. And that's primarily through just increasing access. My research looks at how folks engage with mental health services when they have some of the most severe issues, so suicidality, severe substance use, access to firearms, the things that result in death by suicide. Those folks know that they appear high risk to providers, so they often downplay their symptoms or don't seek care because they don't want to be involuntarily hospitalized. And that happens more frequently at lower levels of care where maybe master's level clinicians, not psychologists, not doctors, don't have the training to do in-depth assessment as well as calm a patient. It requires a lot of training and experience to kind of toe that line and keep a person engaged in treatment. And I think one of the biggest things from the outside to understand is that basically IHS, the VA, all of our tribal health organizations that get federal money are already doing this. If you are a psychologist in the lower 48, licensed in one of those states, you can work for any of those organizations up here receiving that federal money without getting licensed in Alaska. A common experience is to refer a client to the VA and they're seeing a psychologist down in Florida who's not licensed in Alaska. And this happens way less conservatively, risk-wise, than what SciPac would propose, as Dr. Tarlow was just saying, how there are a lot more rules with SciPac than when clients are seeking help with these other organizations. And one of the things that I think Dr. Tarlow mentioned was continuity of care. With these problems that we have in Alaska, these problems we have everywhere in mental health, one of the issues up here with continuity of care is that there aren't a lot of other providers to go to if for whatever reason you have to stop seeing your tribal health organization or you don't want to see the VA anymore. And we, although I don't have direct numbers in front of me, we do a pretty poor job at meeting the overall demand. That's pretty clear. When every place in town has wait lists 3 months long, and providers typically try and do abbreviated courses of treatment, like we follow our strict code of ethics, but oftentimes what we're focused on is stabilizing patients and referring them to a lower level of care. And that's really difficult if, say, we have a service member or a veteran who has to travel for work out of our jurisdiction up here. So I think SciPac would solve a lot of those problems for our stakeholders who rely on these high levels of care that maybe they can't get access to continuously if they have to travel. But also it would really help the private sector if the private sector could play at the same rules as the government, but not because SciPac is stricter. They could help meet the demand. I think that would be really attractive to psychologists in the lower 48. Dr. Zink mentioned earlier about physicians traveling up to do like rotations and how they fall in love with the state. I did my doctoral internship at a tribal health organization as part of our state internship consortium, and there were 9 of us at the start. I was the only Alaskan going in, and I'm the only person from that cohort still in the state. And part of that is because people want to be able to practice in multiple places ethically and legally, and I think SciPac would allow that.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Tucker. Do members have questions?
I do.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you very much. Through the chair, Dr. Tucker, appreciate your input. You know, I'm still trying to get a handle on the psychological services in need in Alaska. My understanding is this compact would allow psychologists to come up and practice temporarily for 30 days and also to practice telepsychology. I guess the first question, continuity of care, does that mean service with the same provider, or does that mean different providers at different times in a patient's treatment or therapy?
Through the chair. Yeah, that could be, continuity of care could be either. Typically in psychotherapy, we're treating like an individual, and continuity of care might be that I'm trying to provide 12 to 15 sessions every week, you know, for 15 weeks to like say a soldier who has PTSD who's just come back. It could be interpreted as not having an interruption in care. For example, you know, if I had stabilized that patient and transferred them to someone, did like a warm handoff to a lower level of professional. But one of the things that is really difficult in Alaska is that I might get a patient onboarded who has, you know, PTSD and maybe a substance use disorder that they've been self-medicating with, and then they're expected to, you know, perform their duties, go down to Louisiana or California to with their unit to get certified to go back to war, and they can't access me via telehealth. So in the case of SciPact, I would be able to get the temporary ability to practice telehealth in those states, so that I could provide that continuity of care. And the demand is something I think that's really hard to study accurately, because so many people who are in need look for services, and then by the nature of their condition, like hopelessness, poor problem solving, these are all like symptoms of depression. They see that there's a long wait and they give up. So it's one of those things that I think even with SciPact, we probably wouldn't be able to meet like the total demand for mental health services realistically. It would be a really good start in that direction, though.
Yeah. And perhaps, follow up?
Sure.
Unless. So kind of following up on a point that you touched on a little bit and Dr. Zink made more explicitly, the idea that if we track someone to come to Alaska to practice professionally, they, of course, will fall in love with Alaska and want to stay. Does this compact actually give any advantage to someone who comes up? Again, if it's supposed to allow them to practice temporarily for 30 days and then practice telepsychology, assumedly forever, indefinitely, what advantages does this compact confer on someone like that other than the 30-day temporary?
Through the chair, that's a great question for the folks here representing SciPact.
Okay, we can go to Patrick Hyde. Would you like to address that question? What benefits does this compact confer other than the ability to work in your first 30 days?
Hello, yes. Can you hear me okay? Sorry,
yes.
I think my camera just got a little bit messed up.
We can hear you.
Excellent. My name is Patrick Hyde. I'm the chair of the SciPact Commission, and I'm also the representative for SciPact for Texas. And Janet Orwig was able to join us. She's also the executive director for SciPact, so I'll probably call on her to help clean up the mess I make when I try to answer your question, and she does a better job of it. But I'd like to try to maybe, if I can, an earlier question that I think one of the representatives asked was sort of the benefit, like how do we know this is going to help the people of your state? And so some of the data that SciPact actually collects is the on renewals is they actually ask them the questions, which states are you providing services into? And so on the SciPact website, there's some historical data for, I believe, the last 3 years, and it'll show how many authorization holders, the APIT holders, which are the people that are providing telepsychology, which states are they actually providing services into? And so Texas, as I'm sure many other states, has a shortage of mental health providers, and there's underserved areas all over the place in our state. And so for us specifically, there's over 1,100 different providers who provided services into the state. So I agree with, you know, what some of the other testimony said is it's not going to fix all the problems, but it'll help. I think it's something that's helping, and we can see in the numbers that there's been, you know, 1,100 people that have been able to provide services into our state because of the compact. So I think that's a net positive for it. And what is the benefit for those licensees? So SciPact is a little bit of a different compact. It's just that's the way the compact was drafted. And so you have to be declare your home state, which is the home state where you're licensed. And then from that home state, you can then provide services to any of the other member states. So there's 41 states plus two territories. So there's now 43 jurisdictions, mm-hmm. the two of them being the Northern Mariana Islands and the District of Columbia. So if Alaska were to join, a licensed psychologist in Alaska could then get an APIT and then provide services in any of the other 43 jurisdictions. So they could then continue to provide services all of those places, and then vice versa. If it's it's a Texas licensed psychologist and they have a client that's, moving to Alaska or is going there for a vacation, they can legally provide services to those. So you're right. The other part of it is there's a temporary, it's a temporary in-person, but there isn't anything permanent. So there isn't something to necessarily cause psychologists to move to other states. It's being able to provide those services legally through those other states. So ultimately, I think your question is getting at is how do you attract more psychologists to move to Alaska? I don't know that SIPAC necessarily does that is the honest answer, but Janet can jump on and tell me, no, there is definitely a way to do that, but it's really more about greater access to care for the patients and being able to provide those across state lines legally.
I'll go back to you, Dan, Representative Sadler, but I first wanted to offer Janet Orwig the opportunity to elaborate or not on what Dr. Hyde or Mr. Hyde said.
Mr.
Okay.
Thank you. Through the chair, Patrick did an excellent job. I really don't think I have anything else to add to that. I do want to highlight that the temporary component, when SIPAC was created, the member jurisdictions for psychology across the state said they wanted to add the temporary component because temporary requirements varied so much by the states, and this allowed a consistency of 30 days in a jurisdiction. So that was why it was added. One of the components are the types of psychologists that use it the most for forensic psychologists that need to go in and do a forensic evaluation. So they do come into the state to do those, and then they can go back out as far as using the temporary component.
Okay. Representative Sadler has another question.
Thank you. And I have a panoply of options here. So either Dr. Hyde or Dr. Pippin. Orwig, pardon me. My question is, with technology and the provision of services over long distance via telehealth, a question arises, where are the services, if a patient is receiving services paid for by Medicaid, whose state Medicaid? If someone is practicing in Alaska on a SIPAC and provides services to someone in Delaware, whose state is responsible for the Medicaid share of that? Or income taxes or anything, frankly. You know, where does this service actually happen?
You want me to take that, Janet?
Go ahead for it. Yes, please.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Mr. Hyde. Thank you.
The SIPAC rules. Oh, sorry.
No, please proceed.
The SIPAC rules specify that it's where the services are delivered. So where the patient is located is where the services are being delivered. So depending on where the patient is, I would say that's probably where where those rules would apply.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you all for being here today. Next up, an invited testimony, and I believe our final invited testifier is Justin Perkins, Executive Director of the Interior Region EMS Council. Mr. Perkins, could you please put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony?
Yeah, for the record, my name is Justin Perkins. I am the Executive Director for Interior Region EMS Council. I'm also a licensed paramedic. I've been a paramedic for about 30 years, working both inside and outside of Alaska. I am testifying on behalf of myself and representing Interior Region EMS Council, and I am strongly supporting House Bill 352. I'm not going to waste your time really getting into the nitty-gritty. I'm just going to kind of give you a story about how Compact has affected me personally and how I see it affecting the region. After spending several years working in EMS in Interior Alaska, I worked my way through EMT 1, 2, 3, attended paramedic school in 2005 through UAF. At that time, paramedics were kind of scarce in the state outside of flight services, Anchorage and Fairbanks fire departments. Those jobs are pretty much non-existent. Thankfully, at the time, I did complete my national registry, and because of that, I was able to easily obtain paramedic licenses in a few other states over the years, New Mexico, Colorado, Louisiana, Wyoming, and Montana, to name a few. Most recently, I've worked outside of Alaska as a flight paramedic in Wyoming. It is a compact state. I was able to obtain a paramedic license in Wyoming within about 24 hours of applying. In the course of my duties, I frequently cross state lines, going to neighboring states, Colorado, Utah, Nebraska, which are some of those are compact and non-compact states. Compact states were super easy for me. I didn't have to change anything in my practice, didn't have to worry about scope of practice, state EMS regulations. I was able to just kind of do my job. The one compact state in the region that, or non-compact state, sorry, was Montana. And Montana was a bit more difficult. With my NRAMP, I was able to get a license in Montana, but it took over about a month, and its process in licensing is very similar to Alaska's. Moreover, whenever I'd fly into Montana through Wyoming and take a patient to a neighboring state, I would have to basically switch hats and put on my Montana license, which changed my scope of practice. It changed the regulations under which I was following. So at best, it really disrupted workflow, caused some potential safety issues, and changed efficiency. It just became very cumbersome. So kind of bring this back to Alaska. In October of this last year, I was offered a job in Fairbanks. That job required that I obtain an Alaska paramedic license. Seeing that I had my initial licensure and training and education in Alaska, you would think that would be super simple. That was not the case. It took almost 3 months for me to get my license back in Alaska, and that's even working closely with the State Office of EMS and in my position in Interior Region. I had significant access to those parties. And even being that case, I still had to submit letters of affidavit from each state in which I had a license. And if you remember, that list I gave you was fairly long. And that took several weeks between each state to get that affidavit sent to the state of Alaska. And then they were able to fast track my application through LMS, but that's only because of my relationships with those state personalities, those folks from that state office. Had that not been the case, I couldn't speak to how long that potentially would have taken. It could have been additional weeks, maybe even months. To add to that, too, working as a flight paramedic in Wyoming, often we'd be invited to go take shifts in neighboring states whenever there was a need from the organization that I worked with that had licensing as an EMS agency in those other states. Alaska was frequently on that list of states that needed personnel. Unfortunately, it's a bit of an island because to be or work in Alaska as a paramedic, you have to have a physician sponsor, have a sponsoring agency. But in order to get one of those jobs, you have to have a license in Alaska. It's kind of this circle where almost like a loop you can't break into. At least the point of entry is very difficult. So even though we had this large pool of paramedics and flight paramedics who were able to potentially go work in Alaska, nobody could. And so they were chronically short-staffed. So just some quick points on where I think this compact would be good for Interior Alaska. We can talk about rapid deployment, right? So if you have disasters, particularly wildfires, allowing licensed EMS professionals from other member states to quickly come to Alaska without having to jump through hoops or cut layers of red tape would be significant. Also, let's talk about our military families. We have 4 military bases in Interior Region, 2 of which are essentially EMS silos. They do not involve themselves at all at any state level. They operate off of federal protocol and national registry because the state's licensing system is so complex and so cumbersome. So I think embracing Compact would ease that burden for them and allow them to integrate more with the communities. And I'd also like to remind the committee that the Compact doesn't lower standards. It ensures that all participating states meet a high uniform bar for background checks, for certification requirements. And I recognize that some organizations in Alaska are opposed to that. But from my perspective, and then from the Interior Region's perspective, to us, it's worth that extra effort to ensure high-quality education and training is being delivered inside of Alaska, especially to our pre-hospital clinicians and providers. So in closing, I would urge the committee to pass House Bill 352, and I'm available for any questions you have.
Thanks, Mr. Perkins. Mr. Perkins is our last invited testifier. In addition to Mr. Perkins, online we have Brian Webb and Glenn Saviors available for questions. Are there questions for Mr. Perkins or other testifiers?
Perkins, go ahead.
Go ahead, Rep. Glenn.
Yeah, so I have a question about the actual bill,
sure.
the psychology part. Okay. I don't know if it's you or I'll just throw it out.
Let's
there
see.
And whoever maybe knows. So I was read through this. This particular compact seems like it's creating the council. It's creating the compact. Like in the past, when we've voted on this, it's a compact that's already existing with other states, mm-hmm. and we're just joining it.
Okay.
But the way the bill's written, it says the compact states hereby create and establish a joint public agency known as the Psychology Interjurisdictional Compact Commission. So I guess my question is, are we trying to get enough states to create this, or is this something we're joining and it's just this is the way it's written in the bill?
Courtney, do you want to answer that, or should we go to the SIPAC folks? Okay. Janet Orwig, could you try to answer that? Are we creating a compact by this bill, or are we joining the existing SciPact in your view?
Thank you. Through the chair, you are joining. That was the way it was written, and in the further in the language, you see that it became a functioning compact when the seventh state joined, which was Georgia in April of 2019. So we have been a functioning compact since April of 2019, and we had our first commission meeting in July of 2019 and started issuing authorizations in July of 2020. So we have been functioning for that amount of time. You would be joining the compact. It is not creating. Thank you.
Just a follow-up.
Of course.
So I guess I'm just kind of hooked up on the hereby create and establish. Is that something that we maybe need to amend in the bill to say join?
Tell you what, Representative Flum, Courtney Owen is here. Listen carefully. We will ask Ledge Legal about the construction of that part of the bill, and if we need to fix it, we will.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Sadler?
A couple lines of questions. I guess to Ms. Orwig, point out for me the provisions for what happens if the state of Alaska were to pass this legislation, join the compact, but then want to change its rules as to how it manages the practices of ecology in Alaska, you know, something esoteric that the rest of the compact does not agree with. What are the provisions for having a minority opinion or dissension? Can we still do that, or must we accept the compact lock, stock, and barrel and be kicked out if we don't adhere?
Through the chair, I'm not quite sure I've got the whole question, so I will try. So if I am understanding correctly, if the commission passes a rule you don't like, or if the state does a rule that it thinks in conflict, I'm not sure.
Through the chair, the latter. What happens if the state of Alaska makes a change that does not match what the compact would expect and require?
So the SciPact legislation does not impact your licensing requirements or how or your psychology act. So you would still be able to license psychologists as you do now. That's not going to impact anything. The only thing SciPact deals with is addresses with someone practicing telepsychology or temporary into your jurisdiction. So it would that shouldn't be an issue if you make a change to your psychology licensing. Requirements that shouldn't impact the SciPact at all. We've had several jurisdictions that have made changes, changed the boards that they're functioning under, but they still are able to meet the SciPact requirements because they have still have a psychology board and they are doing licensing.
I guess to follow up. Yeah, and I guess I'm applying through the chair to Ms. Orwig. I'm applying to this compact some of my assumptions about how compacts operate, and some of them have been rather prescriptive, saying that thou must comply with all of our conditions or we're going to bounce you. You cannot belong. But what I hear you saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is as long as we follow our own rules here, we can stay part of SciPact with no threat to our status in the compact, right?
That is correct, as long as it does not, dealing with telepsychology or the temporary in-person component.
I'm sorry, as long as it does what again?
Doesn't, you don't make a change to say, something that deals with authorization holders being able to come in practice under SciPact in dealing, that kind of change. That would impact or conflict with the SciPact requirements or license, the part that you enacted in the statute.
And to put a point on it, so what happens if the state of Alaska were to do that, were to change its laws to affect telehealth or the temporary? What's the sanction or what's the consequence?
So there is compliance requirements, as well as in the statute you'll see some information about how compliance is handled. We also have several rules that deal with that, and we try to work with the jurisdiction and see where we don't immediately go to kicking you out. There's some remediation, there's working with, there's trying to see if there's ways that we can figure out where the conflict is and how we can fix that.
And could you possibly point me to where in the conflict compact the language is for you just referred to? It's a long one.
It is. Hold, please.
May I try and offer a comment? This is Dr. Tarla.
Thank you for jumping in. Go ahead, Dr. Tarla.
So I think maybe one thing through the chair, if I can add. Historically, before the compact, if a psychologist in another state wanted to practice telepsychology for a patient in Alaska, that would require the psychologist to essentially become a licensed psychologist in Alaska, to get a license to practice here in order to practice across state lines and serve patients here in the state of Alaska. The only thing the compact changes is that it would provide an opportunity to recognize that psychologist's authority to practice across state lines under their license from another member state. It doesn't do anything to change the regulations and rules and legal requirements for how they practice with patients in Alaska. They would still have to follow all the existing regulations for standards of care for patients that are located in Alaska. They would still have to follow the rules here while practicing in Alaska under a license from another state. The only thing SciPact really changes is it cuts out the step where a psychologist in another state would have to essentially get an entire Alaska license in order to practice here. So it makes it easier to provide and seek services across state lines, but as a person with that e-passport credential and then the authorization of practice, that psychologist acknowledges that they will follow all the local rules and regulations for patients in the state where that patient resides. So it doesn't change the authority of like the state licensing board to set the standards for how practice occurs in the state of Alaska. It just says you can practice here without getting an entire Alaska license.
Dr. Tolle, thank you. I understand the point you're making and value that information. But my question is kind of going to, is there, to what, can the compact sanction any member? Or how can Alaska be kicked out of the compact for doing anything? I think, again, what I hear you saying is as long as we follow our own rules, you can meet the conditions of the SciPact. Is there anything that says any sanction for wrongdoing or any reasons by which Alaska would no longer be qualified for the compact? Answer could be no. That's all right.
And go ahead, Ms. Orwig, if you prefer to answer that. Either of y'all.
Okay, yeah. If you don't mind, I'll jump in. I think.
Thank you, Mr. Hyde.
To try to answer the question, look, one of the issues I know we had previously, and I can't remember which state it was, but one of the issues we have is that each state essentially adopts the model language pretty much verbatim or almost identical. There may be some minor differences, but as long as they're not substantively different, they've adopted the same language, they can then become a part of that compact. So the only issue might come up is if a state legislator wanted to change that language and say, it's something that would be specific to the requirements for SciPact that substantively is different, then that may cause some conflict in whether or not they are aligned with all of the other states that have joined the compact. And that's where I know we've had another state where they had something where we had to meet with that state and figure out, is this substantively different? They made, I think, a minor tweak to that legislation. They matched up, and we were happy to have them, as we are with any state that wants to join the compact. So there's nothing where we've ever sanctioned a state or they've been in trouble. The only issue is when a state has enacted the same legislation, they've joined the compact and they're in. It's just whether or not sometimes we've had to vote on whether or not they've adopted the actual same language as all the other states. So trying to better answer your question, if they were to later modify that language, the commission might need to look at the language and say, have they gone a different direction that they're not aligned now with all the other states that have adopted the same agreement, I guess, so to speak. So, but we haven't had anything where we've had to remove a state in the past. We've only had ones where have come up where, and Janet, if you could remind me, I know there was a state that we had to review, and then we were able to work it out. So I can't remember who that was now, off the top of my head.
Representative Freer has a question.
I don't have a question. I think I have the answer where it's located in the bill. So if you go to page 71 of the bill, starting on line 22, sorry, through the chair, rulemaking talks about the rulemaking powers. And then if you go to page 74, starting on line 13, there's oversight, dispute resolution, and enforcement. And that talks about the process, the dispute resolution process, if whatever there was a change or a difference.
Okay.
Thank you. I'll read that. But I'm still kind of driving down. I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but I'm just trying to find out, is there anything we could do wrong that would ever justify kicking out? I understand if there's a difference, if there's a variation, you'll talk to them, you'll talk to them, you'll work with them, you review with them. But what happens if you cannot work it out? Can the compact kick Alaska out if we screw up, to put a very fine point on it?
Any of y'all could take that question.
Yeah.
And if the answer is you have to analyze it, that's fine, too. We do have one more bill today.
Through the chair, there is components of actually termination of a member. But like I said, it would go through a serious process before we would get to that. We have a very detailed rule that details everything that would be done to get to that. And it would have to be a very serious violation, I believe, to have a member kicked out, based on the process that we have worked out with the, not only with the statute language, but also with the rule that further explains it. And that would have been Rule 13 that's on our website.
Okay. Let's do one more question from Representative Carrick, and then we're going to move on to the final bill of the day. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you for being here. And I just want to go back to this question about the non-APA certified psychologists practicing in Alaska. Is that something we've seen in other states? And how are these individuals impacted by SciPact? Is there an opportunity for them to still qualify through other qualification mechanisms? If you've heard that discussion and can comment.
I would like to address that, if that's okay, through the chair. We have that with, I believe they talked earlier, I was not here, but I believe they talked earlier about the six pathways to meeting the educational requirements for the e-passport. There is one that now allows you to go through an attestation process, and we have been processing those without any issue. What it entails is that they do provide us with their transcript. They also provide an attestation form that answers all of the questions that regard the educational programs inside the statute language. So when you're looking at the educational requirements and it says it has to be labeled a psychology program, all of those things, that is part of that attestation form. The current director of their program or the program at the school can fill out that attestation form. They do not have to go and find prior supervisors that they're not able to. They'll be able to go to that school and have those attestation forms completed. We have processed many through that, and they seem to be able to practice and get authorization going forward since that pathway was added.
Okay.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question to the sponsor? Just a brief one, real easy, just a request for information.
Sure.
To the sponsor representative, if you have any information on the relative efficacy of telepsychology versus in-person psychology, I'd love to see it. Thank you. And anybody else who would like to provide, that'd be great, too. Thank you, sir.
Great. We will collect that information and return it to the committee. I appreciate everyone being here today and answering lots of questions and having good discussion. The final bill on the agenda today is HB 305, Transportation Network Company Pay, and we will take
Is there anybody online for public testimony?
Actually, I apologize. We did advertise public testimony for this bill. I will go ahead and open up public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to offer public testimony on HB 352? I also don't see anyone online who wishes to offer public testimony. So I'm going to close public testimony. We can return to public testimony and give another opportunity given the complexity of this bill. At this time, we will transition to House Bill 305, Transportation Network Company Driver Pay, and we will take a brief at ease. All right. Back on the record, last bill of the day, House Bill 305, Transportation Network Company Driver Pay. Evan Anderson is going to walk us through this. This is my bill. He will walk us through the – sorry, they will walk us through this bill, and then we can have an initial discussion and reflection and return to it later. Go ahead, Evan Anderson.
Thanks, Co-Chair, Co-Chair Fields, members of the committee. For the record, Evan Anderson, staff to Rep. Fields. I'll be presenting House Bill 305, a bill to raise pay for the drivers of transportation network companies. Briefly, we'll start with a little bit of legislative history. The 30th legislature adopted HB 132 that was sponsored by Representative Wool in 2017, which I think one of the members on our committee maybe staffed that bill, which permitted the use of app-based ride-sharing platforms in Alaska. And so just to give you an idea of what's in statute from those days, about almost 10 years ago, there's a definition for transportation network company, and that means a corporation or other entity that uses a digital network to connect riders to drivers who provide pre-arranged rides. A little bit of the context for who takes these jobs, who is actually your Uber or your Lyft driver when you request a ride on the platform. As of 2021, these are numbers from Pew Research, 16% of people in the U.S. have worked for a digital labor platform at least once. 31% of those recent workers reported that this was their main source of income. And often we find that people who are most vulnerable to income insecurity are most likely to sign up for platform work. And it's actually 25% of people with lower income surveyed have worked for platforms. So it's a much higher number, 25%, than the 16% of all folks in the U.S. And we've also found that platform workers do not have the same freedoms that independent contractors often have or are supposed to have, such as the freedom to negotiate basic aspects of their work, including how much they are paid. So to take a kind of a big look at Uber, Lyft, and these other transportation network companies, these are massive corporations that have grown significantly since 2017 when the bill to authorize their use in Alaska was originally passed. We were looking at less than $10 billion in overall market capitalization in 2017. Now we're well over $50 billion between the two companies. And as we don't want to use this bill to focus on one company or another. That being said, Uber represents 76% of this market. Lyft is the other 24%. Those numbers were from 2024. And so I would anticipate that Waymo has now eaten up a little bit of a share of the market, but Uber and Lyft are still the vast majority. And the companies have changed their practices quite a lot since 2017. Both companies ran on net losses through to about 2022. And in about 2023, after the pandemic, I should also mention Uber and Lyft both went public in 2019, Lyft in March of that year and Uber in May of that year. And since then, their shareholders have not permitted them to operate at a loss. And so they have shifted their practices to make money at all costs, and that's often been at the expense of their drivers. This is a snapshot from December 31st, 2024. You can see this green graph of earnings dipped into positive for the first time in 2020, in maybe Q3, Q4, 2023. And then in 2024 was the first year, first calendar year in the company's history that there were positive earnings throughout the year. And how have they done that? Largely through manipulating the driver's take-home pay. So this is some research that was conducted back in 2021. I think it was in the Bay Area. They found that the take rate for these companies was as high as 52%. Some more research from the National Employment Law Project shows that also in the Bay Area and in California, that Uber's take rate is as high as 66, 67% in some instances. You can see in in the images that someone who's paying $75 as the rider for a fare, I think it's $73 for this fare, the driver is receiving $25 in take-home pay. That's the example on the left. The example on the right, that's a $49 fare. The driver is receiving $16 in pay. Informal surveys of drivers in South Central Alaska suggest a prevailing take rate in Alaska of around 45% of the posted price for the ride. That's leaving drivers with just about 55%. So we're kind of around the national average there. And I want to be clear, the average take rates in Alaska in 2017, 2018 were much closer to the full price of the fare. And we found national and international research that backs that up, a trend that these companies are charging higher and higher take rates on the drivers. So we have surveyed and informally and talked to a number of drivers in South Central Alaska and here in Juneau. There is some anonymous testimony that we've shared with the committee that I've included. We've included some excerpts here. This driver talks about upfront pricing. And I do want to highlight that term. This is the algorithm. They use the term upfront pricing because it kind of sounds good for drivers that you would know how much money you might make. But this is a term that they're using to obscure the fact that they're using algorithmic pricing across the board in all of the markets that they can. And so this driver has said that she used to get paid $65 to drive someone from Anchorage to the Valley, to Wasilla, and now it's considerably less, and so she will no longer take those trips because it's not worth her time and the cost on her vehicle. And I thought this quote at the end, she says she's at the mercy of Uber because they need the income while they look for another job. They don't want to file for unemployment, so they have to deal with it. And digging in a little bit more to the take rates, you can see that prior to the pandemic, take rates were right around 40%. People used a lot less Ubers in 2020 during the pandemic as they were going fewer places. And so those take rates actually started to come down considerably. But it was in August of 2022 when the company implemented the upfront pricing that we see take rates suddenly start to increase significantly. That's the graph on the lower half of the screen. The graph on the upper half of the screen shows that rider prices continue to increase from 2022 when upfront fares were implemented to this graph goes until February of last year, while driver pay during that same time period has decreased considerably and at a very different ratio. And during that time, Uber has also rallied its stock by 300% and is now performing pretty well on the stock market. I think for this last slide, we just wanted to kind of go over the process of how someone accepts, one of these jobs or when you log in to book a ride, how that process works. The courier, the driver logs into the platform. AI is used to evaluate their prior behavior. The algorithm is used to offer jobs to the courier. The driver accepts or declines, and the behavior metrics are updated and fed back into the AI algorithm. And so in practice, what workers actually take home is largely dictated by these AI algorithmic pricing systems that control the overall profitability of a ride and how often a job is assigned to an individual. We also saw in that anonymous testimony that driver reported that she feels pressure to accept the rides, even if they're not for a lot of pay, because if you don't accept rides, you'll receive fewer ride requests in the future, ultimately impacting your pay as well. So that concludes the short presentation. I'm happy to go through a sectional if the chair wishes.
Let's take a brief pause. I'll just briefly describe when I started looking at this bill and then maybe go to invite testimony and then ask questions if that's okay. So in 2022, I read a study by the Economic Policy Institute about a dismal portrait of gig workers, primarily rideshare drivers, in the nation. Some of the key findings from that study were 1 in 7 gig workers were earning less than the federal minimum wage, which is maybe a third what it would take to survive in Alaska. 3 out of 5 gig workers lost earning because of technical difficulties with their app. This is extraordinary. Almost 20% of gig workers were going hungry, and nearly 1/3 of gig workers could not pay their utility bills the prior month. So by the early 2020s, it seemed that these are industries that had set up an employment model that was built on poverty wages. And one of the interesting things, when you go back to the original bill that classified these drivers as independent contractors, I think it's clear at this point that the drivers have zero power to control the terms and conditions of their work, and therefore no longer meet Alaska's statutory definition of independent contractor. So what do we do about that? Because it's simply totally different. And I think when you look around the country, lots of states, lots of cities are grappling with how do you prevent an entire industry from becoming a poverty wage industry that both fleeces consumers and impoverishes workers simultaneously while enriching companies who don't return anything to the state of Alaska. And one of the challenges is any driver who testifies can be cut off of their source of employment. The companies have absolute power to crush their drivers' prospects for work, and that will be an ongoing challenge for us. At this time, hopefully, Emily Dott with SEIU Local 775 is available to testify.
Hello. Sorry, can you let me know if there's too much background noise here and I can vote?
A little bit of background noise, and try non-speaker if...
Okay, I'll go ahead and move into another. Give me 1 minute.
Okay, and we can hear you.
Hello, is this a bit better?
That sounds better. Yep. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Sorry. 1 second. I need to grab my phone to keep my wife.
I guess while Ms. Dott is getting on, I would...
Hello.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, Ms. Dott.
So sorry about that. My name is Emily Dott. I am with SEIU 775, which is the Caregivers Union in Alaska. But before I worked at SEIU 775, I had the chance to work with gig workers on policies to raise pay in Washington State and in Seattle. So I'm here testifying in support of House Bill 305 to raise pay for rideshare drivers. Here in Seattle, drivers won laws to create a minimum wage at the city level back in 2019, and those laws were so successful and so life-changing for workers, they took it to the state in 2023 and passed a law across Washington to set minimum pay for TNC drivers. I got a chance to work with another group of gig workers, which are delivery drivers and task-based gig workers, to create their own policy here in Seattle to create minimum pay, flexibility protections, and protections against unfair deactivation. Policies like this are crucial as the gig economy expands to every corner of our workforce. Big tech thinks that they have found the ultimate workaround for having to actually pay workers, and the reality is under current law, they have found a way to pay dramatically below minimum wage. In fact, some studies have shown that after taking mileage costs and time into account, drivers are earning as little as half of minimum wage. So it's crucial for us to recognize that as independent contractors, drivers are responsible for huge costs that traditional workers don't have to cover. So while Uber's executives are paid to cover gas and wear and tear for every mile they put on the personal vehicle, their drivers aren't paid for mileage at all. And as contractors, drivers cover their employer-side payroll taxes, and that lets companies like Uber and Lyft off the hook. On top of all of those extra expenses, drivers work hours and hours of work that is completely uncompensated. So after they drop off a customer, they often have to drive back to a central hub to find their next ride. And that time and that mileage is completely unpaid too. That's why it's critical that this policy creates both a basic pay standard and acknowledges the deadhead time that drivers have to work. For any other worker, all of that would be considered work time. Gig workers' time is worth no less than any other worker's work time, and their bills cost no less money than any other workers. So like all workers, they need to be paid enough to make ends meet, take care of their families, and contribute to the economy. Here in Washington, the proof is quite clear. We have passed laws to protect gig workers, both TNC drivers and other gig workers, and those laws have really lifted up pay here in Seattle and across the state. And that means lifting up not only workers, but the entire economy. After the passage of PayUp, which was our gig worker minimum pay law here in Seattle, the workers that I worked with reported finally being able to make rent every month without having to borrow from friends and family. They reported being able to see the doctor for the first time in years, and maybe even being able to go out to dinner and spend money at a local restaurant, contributing back to their family. So these laws really are life-changing for workers and for their communities. A really important note here is that laws like this also put an end to a two-tiered system of worker protections that frankly has roots in racism. When we look around and we see that the people making the least money and getting the least protections are people of color and immigrants, it's important to take action to balance those laws and extend worker protections to everyone. So it's really exciting to see Alaska taking this step and finally acknowledging what a dozen other cities and states have acknowledged, that all workers need basic rights, and that includes gig workers. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Ms. Dot. And I should have mentioned, so I've been serving my Lyft drivers, and my observation is that in South Central and Anchorage, they earn about 45% of the fee, whereas in Juneau, it can be higher because there are fewer drivers in Juneau, so Lyft has to pay them more and charge more. So yeah, my last ride to the airport from the Capitol in Juneau was $40, which is an extraordinary amount of money for such a short distance. The driver earns 72% of that, whereas when I take a ride from my house to the airport in Anchorage, the drivers typically earn 45%. For longer rides in Anchorage, the drivers get as low as 40%. So from the valley to the airport or the airport to the valley, the drivers are earning 40%. And, of course, they have that long deadhead distance, like Ms. Dot mentioned on the way back. And I would ask that other committee members consider asking their drivers, because when you get in the car, you can ask them, what are you getting paid? And we can get more data points since the companies do not reveal that. Do members have questions for Ms. Dot? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Dot, for being here. We will return to this bill at a future date. At 4:59, we're adjourned.